Hello and welcome. You are about to participate in an exciting verse-by-verse Bible study. This program offers an exegetical, historical, grammatical approach to the Bible. Our host, pastor-teacher Bob Utley, tries to corroborate his teachings from five areas: word studies from the original languages, grammatical construction, context, parallel passages, or historical and theological insights. This is one of several series that Bob teaches weekly. Get your Bible and let's begin our prayerful study of today's lesson.
Hello, we're continuing our study in Mark, and we're going to be dealing with the last part of chapter 10, first 14 verses of chapter 11. We're dealing with two basic accounts, the healing of blind Bartimaeus and the triumphal entry. And that's all we're going to be trying to do today. These are some important accounts with some real implications for interpreting the Bible. And by that I mean, I want you to look with me in your Bible to Mark 10:46. Now I want you to notice that I'm using William's translation, of course, and it says, "Then they came to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho..." Now, if you look at Luke 18:35, it says as they were approaching Jericho. If you'll compare that with Matthew 20:29, it says as they were going out of Jericho. Now, what we have here is an obvious contradiction. One says approaching, one says leaving. Also, if you'll read the parallel passage in Matthew, which is Matthew 20:29-34, and while I'm on it, parallel for Luke is Luke 18:35-43. If you'll read Matthew, there are two blind men. Now, if you're familiar with Mark, Mark has one Gadarene demoniac, one blind man, and on and on. But if you'll read Matthew, Matthew has two Gadarene demoniacs, two blind men. It's a characteristic of Matthew to have two. It's a characteristic of Mark and Luke to have one. Now, do we have a discrepancy here, a contradiction in the Bible? No, in my opinion, we have an eyewitness account that shows the genuineness of this. It's not a forced mechanical unity. Now, I don't know why it is that Matthew consistently has two. Even the donkeys. Matthew's going to have the mother and the colt. Mark's just going to have the colt. Matthew always seems to have two. Now, I don't understand exactly the relationship to the Synoptic Gospels. There is material that is changed around from here to there. I've done several tapes on inspiration. One on inerrancy versus infallibility, and on inspiration, not how, but why. I think it's important that if you're interested in this, you'll write for those tapes. I think they'll be helpful. Now, the key to this is that I think that we're communicating truth through eyewitnesses. And so I don't demand a literalism of these accounts with forced unity. I think the essence of the message is there, whether you have two blind men or one. And so it really doesn't concern me if the Gospels are different. To me, it's a sign of genuineness. Now, it's about the going into Jericho and going out of Jericho. Jericho is one of the oldest inhabited cities in the ancient Near East. Matter of fact, archaeologically, it is the oldest inhabited site. It is known as the perfumed city. That's what Jericho means. It's often called the city of palms. Jericho was rebuilt by the Romans under Herod. And the new city, the new Roman Jericho, was about 1 mile from the old Jericho. Now, isn't it quite possible that one of the synoptics says they were leaving old Jericho and the other synoptic says they were entering new Jericho? I think that's the what we have here, and not the wild discrepancy on who's going and who's coming. But again, I'm not concerned about, is there one or two? Are they leaving or going out? The essence is what Jesus said, what Jesus did. And there's a real uniformity in the accounts on that. To me, that's the essence of who he is and what he did. The details are not as important or significant to me. Now, notice it says a large crowd. Now, who would this be? Well, they're on their way to Jerusalem. I want to show you a map, if I could, because I think you'll get the idea of what's happening here. Maybe go to the map. Notice, if you will, that Jesus is coming from the area of the Sea of Galilee. But they hated the Samaritans. And so what the Jews would do who lived in Galilee, they'd go and they'd cross over the Jordan River and then go down the eastern bank in Perea until they came to this ford in the Jordan River right here, and they'd cross over at Jericho and then go the 18 miles to Jerusalem. So what we have is pilgrims going down this very traditional way, and Jesus is with them, and the pilgrims are still going to Jericho and down to Jerusalem. And so I think we still have the pilgrims, that large crowd, not of disciples or curious people about Jesus, but pilgrims going to the Passover. And Jesus fit right in with them. Now, it says Timaeus, son of Bartimaeus. It is highly unusual for Mark to name people. He doesn't name the Gadarene demoniac. He doesn't name anybody. But here he names it. Now, Timaeus means unclean. How would you like to be known as the son of the unclean? Well, that's what this guy was. Apparently, he was a blind beggar. Now, this is a blind beggar was sitting on the roadside. There were probably many of these. These beggars were, they may have been poor, but they weren't ignorant. And so they knew all these pilgrims were coming, and they wanted to be the first one to hit them up. So they moved out to Jericho. I'm sure there's blind beggars all the way from Jericho to Jerusalem. It's kind of like hitchhikers. You want to get just in front of the last person, right? Well, that's what they were doing here. These blind beggars probably came from Jerusalem all the way to Jericho to catch these pilgrims. Verse 47. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout. Now, the imperfect tense is used here. He began to shout over and over again. Recently, I was watching one of the parades on New Year's Day, the Rose Bowl, and it was just lined with people. Can you imagine a setting like that with just throngs of people kind of in a parade atmosphere? And someone starts screaming at one of the people who are walking by in the parade. Help me! Help me! You can imagine the confusion. All those people, all the scribes and Pharisees and children, and here's these blind beggars, and one of them screaming out, Jesus of Nazareth, help me. Now, apparently he had heard about Jesus, knew he was not afraid of the common man, knew that he had healed people. Jesus' reputation had spread all over the Holy Land. And so he began to scream, Jesus, Son of David, do pity me. Now, in Matthew 20:30, it's Lord. Now, this word Lord is, of course, the Greek word kurios. It can mean sir. It can mean mister. It can mean a theological deity. And it depends on the usage. Here, I don't know what the man's saying. Probably sir, mister, something like that. You son of David. Now, this goes back to 2 Samuel chapter 7. It was a messianic title because they expected a divinic ruler. With super endowed God-given ability and militaristic powers. Now, Jesus would not usually accept this term. He does not chide this man for using it. He just responds to him. Now, probably this man had a nationalistic, militaristic understanding. The Old Testament closed out in Malachi and around the 350 B.C. time in the Persian period. And during this interbiblical period, the period of the Maccabees and Alexander the Great and his four generals and the rise of Rome, there developed a very large body of intertestamental literature that describes in detail the coming of the Messiah. A good one would be Enoch does that and several others. And they were very nationalistic, very militaristic as far as who the Messiah was. And I'm sure this man was influenced by that. Now, this do pity me is an aorist imperative. Now, it's a very strong way. He was saying, do it now, commanding Jesus, heal me now or have pity on me now. This is a very common phrase in the Psalms, as you might want to see. For just one example, Psalm 51:1 is an example of this phrase used throughout the Psalter. Now, notice where it says in verse 48, many of the people begin to rebuke him. Now, Luke even adds sternly that the people in the crowd said, will you shut up? You're just disrupting the parade. You're just causing the disturbance. Will you quit hollering like that? Now, friends, the more they said quit hollering, the louder this man hollered, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Boy, he was just screaming at the top of his lungs trying to get Jesus' attention. Now, he couldn't tell if he was far or near. So he was really screaming. Everybody was saying, will you shut up? Now, notice in Luke 18:39, it says those who were in the lead, those who had pushed to the head of the crowd, were telling him to be quiet. But all the louder he kept shouting, you, Son of David, do pity me. You can almost see this scene. Jesus stopped and said, tell him to come here. Jesus is 6 hours away from Jerusalem, 18 miles. And he had time, last chapter, to stop and bless the children. And now he has time to deal with a poor, blind beggar. Tell him to come here. And they told the blind man, saying, cheer up, get up, he's calling you. Isn't that just like us? These very same folks who said, well, you shut up, you're just causing trouble, he's not going to... They're saying, oh, well, he did call you. How about that? Get up and go see him now. I don't know how they expect him to find him, but anyway. And look at verse 8. He threw off his coat and jumped up and went to Jesus. Now, throwing his coat it doesn't seem very astonishing to us, but I remember a picture of another healing of Jesus, a blind man. It's a modern picture where the blind man is going to Jesus, and the picture shows where he was sitting, and his blind man's cane is resting against the wall. We see that man believed that Jesus was going to heal him. and he left his blind cane laying against the wall. Well, friend, it's the very same picture. You see, this coat was what this man slept in. This is what he used to collect alms or food. It'd be like a modern blind man having a tin cup. This man so believed that Jesus was going to heal him that he left his coat from where he got up and ran in the dark, pushing his way through the crowd, couldn't see him where. He was just going toward Jesus. Now, he jumped up and went to Jesus, and Jesus asked him, "What do you want me to do for you?" Now, you think that's a rhetorical question? Quite often in the Gospels, Jesus asks people questions when he's dealing with it. He asked the father about how long the boy had been sick and on and on. Jesus begins a dialogue with these people to elicit their faith in him. Now, he, as the Son of God, certainly knew the condition of this man, as he knew all things and could read men's mind, apparently. But, friends, he wanted this man to begin into a dialogue with him. So he asked him this simple question, "What can I do for you, sir? What do you want me to do for you?" The blind man answered, "Good teacher." Now, this, of course, would be Rabbi, Rabboni. It's an affectionate term. In Luke 18:41, it's the word Lord again. Now, how much theological meaning is there, we just can't tell. "I want to see again." You know, those Pharisees and scribes were in that crowd that day. They had been looking for a sign. They wanted confirmation that Jesus was the Messiah. And, you know, they had it every day. Jesus did these miracles of healing the blind and the lame and preaching to the poor and helping the weak. Friends, those are messianic predictions. Isaiah 35, 4 and 5. Isaiah 42, 7 and 16. Those signs were right there, but they didn't see them. Then Jesus said to him, "Go, your faith has cured you." Now Matthew adds, "touching his eyes." And probably he did that. Jesus, this man couldn't see what he was doing, so Jesus made sure he touched his eyes. It has always amazed me as I have read the Gospels how different Jesus healed people. To some blind people, he just said, "See," and they saw. Others, he made spit out of the ground and wiped it on their eyes. Others, he healed them partially and had to go back and do it again, lay hands on them. Friends, he never did it the same way. This man, apparently, he laid his hands on his eyes so the man would know what he was doing. Obviously, I bet he prayed for the man. And the man, he said, "Your faith has saved you." Now, notice it's not the man's faith that saved him. It's the man's faith in Jesus. It's the object of the faith that's crucial, not the extent or amount of the faith. Jesus said the faith the size of a mustard seed will do it if we just have it in the right place. Now, when it says cured you, literally here is the word saved. Now, we're using saved in its Old Testament connotation of physical deliverance, not in its New Testament sense of spiritual salvation. Though I truly believe, though it's an implication I'm bringing to the text, that everybody that Jesus dealt with physically, he also dealt with spiritually. I think it'd be a tragedy for Jesus to heal a man's blind eyes physically and not open the eyes of his heart to himself as the Messiah. So I believe he dealt with all these men. We don't know how long he spent or how he did it, but I just have to believe that he dealt with them on a spiritual level as well as a physical level. And all at once he could see again. He began to follow Jesus along the road. Now Luke 18:43 says he was glorifying God. You bet he was. Now probably he wasn't becoming a disciple. He was probably from Jerusalem, like I said, and just melt the pilgrims early to try to get more alms. And he was going back to be with his family. He was just heading for the temple to thank God and was going along with Jesus. What a beautiful, beautiful picture of on his way to the cross, Jesus cared about people. Friends, this side of the cross, how much more do you think Jesus cares about us? Now, I'm not saying he's going to heal every one of you who are blind and fix every one of you who have physical problems, but I want you to know the Master, the Lord, cares about us. Now, in verse 11 and following, we're going to be dealing with the triumphal entry. Let me give you the parallels, if I could. Matthew 21, 1 through 9, Luke 19, 29 through 40. Now, what we have here is this triumphal entry. And I want to say a few things because I want you to think with me through the setting of this. Apparently, the people of Jerusalem came out as far as Jericho to welcome the pilgrims into town on the feast days. All the villages around Jerusalem opened their homes to these pilgrims, let them stay with them, because there was no Holiday Inn, of course, and no rooms in Jerusalem. It swelled to three times its normal size. Apparently, what is going to happen here is a liturgical thing that happened every year. To some extent, they said these same Hillel Psalms. They welcomed the pilgrims. They shouted these same voices. Little did they know that this time It was the King of Kings and Lord of Lords they were talking about. Now, the Romans were very nervous on these feast days because of the large crowds. If it had been something unusual, the Romans would have acted immediately. The crowd disperses after Jesus goes to the temple. So, obviously, it's a liturgical annual thing, and they don't recognize the full significance of what they are saying. Now, when they were getting near Jerusalem, that is, they were at Bethpage, which means house of figs, and Bethany, which means house of fish. You might want to see John 11:18. It says it's 2 miles from Jerusalem. In front of the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples on ahead and said to them, "Go into the village in front of you, and as soon as you get there, you will find a colt tied, which has never been ridden by a man. Untie it, bring it here. And if anyone asks you what you are doing, why you are doing that, answer, 'The Lord needs it, and will soon send it back here.'" Now, I certainly believe in a Jesus who can read men's minds and know the future. Friends, you don't know what fish is going to have a corn in its mouth and that Peter's going to catch it and not know something about tomorrow. But here I think this sounds more to me like a prearrangement than it does prediction. And there are several other places in the Gospels where it may be a prearrangement. You might want to see Luke 14:12-16. It's another prearrangement, I think, instead of a prediction. Now, what is the significance of a colt that has been tied and never ridden? Now, if I said to you, "Get out your donkey." Donkeys aren't very noble creatures in our society. And if I said, "Get out your Arabian stallion," that'd have a whole different context. Nobody has hardy Arabian stallions. And if they do, they race them. They don't ride them around. But in Israel, the donkey was the royal animal. David had his own donkey. Solomon had his own donkey. Remember Absalom, when he took over from his father, he rode David's donkey and took David's concubines, which was a sign of that he was taken over as king. Well, anyway, nobody rode that donkey but the king. Now, do you see something significant here about Jesus coming to Jerusalem on a donkey that had never been ridden before? Now, this is fulfillment of prophecy. Back in Genesis 49:11, we have the example of the blessing of the 10 tribes of Israel, really just the 10 boys then. In Judah, where it says that the scepter shall not depart until Shiloh comes, in that same passage it says, "And he'll come riding on a donkey." That sounded somewhat unusual then, but later it came to have great significance. Now, another place, prophetic place, very important, is Zechariah 9:9. And you ought to read that whole passage, chapter 9, before you try to interpret this passage. Now, notice where it mentions here, it says in the last part of verse 3, "The Lord needs it." It is highly unusual for Mark to use the word "Lord." Very unusual. And here we have a use of it. Verse 4. "So off they went and found a colt tied outside a door at the street corner. They untied it, but some bystanders..." Now, Luke 19:33 says the owners said, "What are you undoing untying the colt?" And they answered as Jesus had directed them, and so they let them bring it. Now, in Matthew 21:3, it adds there was the parent donkey there. Again, there's Matthew with his two when Mark and Luke have one. Verse 8. "And many of the people spread their coats on the road, and others scattered layers of leaves cut from the fields." Now, this seems unusual. As I was watching several years ago some of the football games from Houston where the fans waved those the blue and white pom-poms from the Oilers, or up there in the Seattle Superdome, the wave they use where they wave those pom-poms. I live in a college town, and we used to have a little colored handkerchief, the color of our team, that we would wave. And it was kind of a cultural way of us saying, "Hooray, hooray." Well, there is a Jewish cultural way of greeting people on religious occasions. Now, they did this specific at the Feast of Booths, but apparently it was so traditional that they did this many times. Now, some say it was palm leaves. Now, if it was palm leaves, they had to carry them from Jericho, because there are no palms at all in Jerusalem. Jericho is the closest place. I really think it's all kinds of branches and leaves. And they laid down their clothes as a significant measure of welcoming these pilgrims, and this time it was the King of Kings himself. Now, here's what they were shouting: "Welcome him." Now, literally, it means "save now." And it's the very familiar word, Hosanna, "save now." And this is part of the Hillel Psalm. Psalms 113-118 are psalms that were sung at the Passover season. And the quote here is directly from Psalms 118:22-29, specifically verse 26. "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed be the coming reign of our father David. Welcome him from on high." Now, folks, that's extremely messianic. The one who's coming in the name of the Lord, the one who's coming to reign for our father David, that is messianic prediction. Now, they may have said it every year, but boy, it had extreme fulfillment this time with this person. Now, in Luke 19:39, the Pharisees got furious over this. They recognized that by Jesus riding on the donkey, they knew the scriptures, they recognized how unique this particular time was in that he was accepting this acclamation, and they said, "Tell him to stop, teacher. Tell him to stop." Jesus said, "If they stop, the rocks will cry out." Oh, hallelujah, man. What an entry. He's coming to his own, and his own are not going to receive him. Now, these Pharisees understood what he was saying, what he was doing, what he was claiming. And I want to tell you this, Jesus signed his death warrant by accepting the acclamation of this crowd right in the central sphere of influence of the religious leaders in Jerusalem. They were jealous already, and this made them all the more jealous when they saw that an annual thing they said was taking on new significance because of who Jesus claimed to be. Friends, they knew their Bibles very well, and there was no doubt to them what Jesus was claiming. Now, and then in verse 11, so he went into Jerusalem. Now, we learn from other accounts that he wept over the city and on and on. Now, he went to the temple. Now, this is the word for the whole temple area. He didn't go into the place where the priest went. He didn't go to the Holy of Holies. Jesus went where he was expected. He went to the court of the Jews. He just looked around that day. I'm sure he saw all the money changers and the hustle and bustle and people cutting across the temple area to get to from the Mount of Olives to the city and all of that. But he didn't do anything today because it was getting close. He had walked 18 miles that day from Jericho. It was getting late, so he's not going to do anything today. He's just going to look it over and then go back. You might want to see John 12:16, where it talks about the disciples didn't quite understand all that was happening either. Now, he went back to Bethany. Why Bethany? Well, he had special friends there. Is it unusual to you that Jesus had special friends? I think Jesus felt comfortable enough in Mary and Martha and Lazarus' house he could take off his shoes and put up his feet, if you please. He knew he was welcome and he felt at home. I'm so glad Jesus had special friends. It just shows me of his humanity again and again. So he stayed at Bethany there with them. He went out with the 12 to Bethany. The next day when they were walking over from Bethany to the Jerusalem, the temple, he felt hungry. It must have been early. He must not have eaten before they left. Now in the distance he saw a fig tree covered with leaves. And he went to see if it might have some figs on it. But when he got to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the time for figs. Now, Jesus wasn't a dum-dum. Let me ask you, if you start looking for a nice, red, juicy apple May, would you be surprised there wasn't any apples there? Now, there's going to be some little apples, but there's going to be no juicy apples till the fall. Now, Jesus knew it was the wrong time of year for figs. So why would he walk up this tree, who apparently had some lush foliage because it's protected somewhat in Jerusalem by the winds there in the valley or something, but apparently had lush foliage, but no figs. No fig tree in the world would have had figs in that area that time of year. Why did Jesus say out loud he's going to speak to the disciples? So look at verse. So he spoke to it. Jesus spoke to a tree. Does that make any sense to you? He spoke to the tree so that he could teach the disciples something. What? Why would Jesus curse a fig tree for having no figs when it wasn't the right time of year for figs? Now think with me. Jesus is trying to teach the disciples right in the headquarters of rabbinical Judaism. You see, the fig tree, as the olive vine, was a symbol of the nation of Israel. Jeremiah 29:17, Hosea 9:10, Joel 1:7, Micah 7:1-6. Jesus is, by this symbolic act, is passing judgment on the political national entity known as the rabbinical Judaism of that day. Now, this is a very difficult subject. In this same chapter, verses 20 and 21, the fig tree shrivels up the next day, and Peter says, "Look, the fig tree shriveled up." Why would Jesus do this? Now, here's my problem. As a student of the Bible, I know that God made some promises to national Israel. And those promises are reflected in Romans 9-11. But I also believe that Jesus judged national Israel as the means of proclaiming the good news to all the world. I want you to look with me, if you will, at Mark 12:1-12 and Luke 13:6-9 for what I believe is the rejection of national Israel as the bearer of the good news. But friends, when I say that, I also want to say to you that I believe God still has a plan for national Israel. Now, I know all the historical problems about the Eastern European Khazars and the modern state of Israel is not really genetically the people of Abraham. I know all that. But I still got to believe that Isaiah 9 through 11 says that God, because of who He is going to protect national Israel in a unique way, not because they're so good, but because of His namesake. And that somehow in the future eschaton, somehow in the last time, there is going to be a place and a purpose for national Israel, though I must admit to you in all my studies of eschatological passages like Daniel, Zechariah, Revelation, and Matthew 24 and Mark 13, I do not know specifically what God is going to do. I do not think that Revelation is primarily a Jewish book. I believe it's primarily a Christian book. I do not believe the church is missing from the book of the Revelation. But I do want to say I still believe there's a place for national Israel because of God's faithfulness. Though as far as the gospel, as the questions about their individual salvation, I do not have the final answer. And I just must admit that to you. Now, I also want to say this idea about fruit is a very significant concept. The parable of the soils tells me that fruit is a symbol of spiritual salvation. This tree had lots of leaves. It looked like it ought to have fruit. That's what national Israel looked like. She seemed to have all the things that God promised, and yet there was no fruit. I think that's true in many Christian lives. They seem to have the outward foliage of spirituality, but the fruit is the confirmation of spiritual salvation, not foliage. And you all look at the parable of the soils. It's a very interesting parable. Now I want to look over at verses 20 and 21 just to close this section. In the morning, as they were passing along, they noticed the fig tree had withered clear down to its roots. Total destruction. And Peter remembered about it. Now, remember, John Mark, the gospel, is the eyewitness account of the Apostle Peter. And so many of these little details are included here that aren't included in the other gospels. And he said to him, "Look, teacher, rabbi, the fig tree you cursed has withered." And I think it's a symbol about national Israel. I've enjoyed being with you today. I hope you'll read this over and read the parallels. Read it in several English translations. Outline it in your own words and see how it applies to your Holy Spirit-led conscience. And good luck in your class. I've enjoyed being with you. God bless you.